without revolutionary thinking.
You gotta prepare your people for what is coming down.
We have no revolutionary action.
Yeah, I think Ferguson signifies the end of the age of Obama. It's a very sad end. We began with tremendous hope, and we end with great despair.
Black resistance to white supremacy is at an all-time low.
Libation is a sacred act which symbolically expresses meaning on several levels at once.
Black American culture, not the appropriate culture for us, because it's filled with too many reactionary elements and too many people in the state.
I hope this opens your eyes, and I hope you will begin to see that these systems are really playing games with us. They're playing games.
If you kill one, you will kill two. Because you should. The whole white Jewish community is getting on. But if you kill umpteen black, I am not supposed to say anything. I don't want to.
I'm from the other side of town. Out of bounds.
Hello, family. This is Brian Mary Deese. The program you are about to listen to has not been numbered. I am only releasing it under the MT Marotti banner, because that is what I originally meant to do. I finished writing the speech that you will hear in March of this year. I decided to wait to release it so I might understand further what I would do with the podcast. Now that I understand further what I'll do with the podcast, which is I will start to publish it consecutively and consistently in the new year, probably around February. I can release this knowing that it won't be the last of its kind. That was sort of a fear of mine. When the podcast does come back, it will not be structured as it is structured now. There will be immense change to that structure. There will be a website which you can access the podcast from. And there will be a lot more content put in a context in which you can use. The podcast will be unapologetically black. It will be aimed towards black people and black-minded people. There is likely going to be instances where I speak of class in ways that affect more than just black people, for we are both trapped in a caste and in a class system. It is not my determination at the onset of this podcast to alienate people. In fact, on many occasions, I will seek to unite. But when praying for direction for this podcast, a message came screaming to me loud and clear. Black people need for themselves, their lineage, their history, a place, a location, to be unapologetically black, to grow ourselves spiritually in the hopes that we can, pardon me, in the knowledge that we will grow ourselves physically. Too often we separate those two. The speech which you will hear does not adhere to that destination. It can't. And there will be often times when I have to present information to you which grows us physically but doesn't do much for us spiritually, or even vice versa. And then sometime down the road, the two will be bridged. This speech was a difficult one. I had hoped to complete it by December of last year. Like many of you, I fell into the certainty that Hillary Clinton would win. And although people like to say constantly and consistently that she would have been devastating to the black community, I maintain, after seeing her betrayed by the elite twice, that they knew something that we don't. They did not want her in that position. And I feel unequivocally that they didn't want her in that position because they feared that she could get a progressive, what people call a progressive, agenda through. She was not betrayed once, but twice by these people. They feared her and gave us a monster instead. I am no apologist for the Democrats. The Democrats have done little, if anything, but cause pain for black Americans. But aside from being a hardcore black liberationist without an ability to see the broader field, I am not. Black people need to speak about liberation in the context of reality. And the reality, which far too many of us do not want to admit to, is that there is a changing landscape internationally. Dr. King said to Dick Gregory, one of the finest gifts the man ever gave to us was this quote, that he felt that black people were integrating, or that he was helping his people integrate into a burning house. We need to now understand that that burning house is a burning building. And like the Twin Towers, it is nearly collapsed. We have to decide now whether or not we are going to approach the traditional liberation struggle in a new way, or if we are going to try to rely on old ways to accomplish things that are no longer feasible. The United States of America owes over $20 trillion to the world. The United States of America has been bullying the world since the end of World War II, to speak of anything and nothing, truthfully, that they've done prior to World War II. The world has not forgotten this, even if we hope that they did. they happen. And the world right now is constructing things that are aimed at either tearing down what the United States has built or to severely cripple it so that it cannot do what it has been doing for the last 70 or 80 years. Black people, black beings as I like to call us, because we are not people, we are beings, have been led to believe that our struggle should never consider the broader ramifications and or implementations. That if we are going to truthfully talk about liberation, we should never take into account the broader realities of the social and political and cultural landscape. That's for white folks to do. And yet, every single roadblock we come up against is tossed at us from those ramifications which we fail to understand that we have to take into account. We have been crippled by our lack in doing this. Our elder ancestor, Amos Wilson, may he rise in power, tried telling us of this necessity. Our still present elder ancestor, Marimba Ani, tried to introduce us to this fact in her book, Yorugu. When you flip through the pages of the content which she lists as resources, you'll see something called psychohistory. There's even something called psychoeconomics, which is not a fully developed discipline. To understand psychohistory, you must understand psychology. To understand psychology, you must understand concepts of sociology, anthropology, even political and economic development. In other words, fields that most of us have not bothered to study in. We need to change that. But it goes even deeper than that. Because what was once thought of as fantasy to us is no longer fantasy. There is a place for metaphysics in all of this. A place which I'll dive into more succinctly as the podcast evolves and develops over the next couple of years after we begin in February. All of these things have come together to give us Donald J. Trump. And this was difficult for me to understand a year ago. I had just really started taking seriously metaphysics. Metaphysics, though it is presented as something completely different, is the undergirding philosophy, the undergirding that which holds it up, philosophy. And we'll talk a lot about vocabulary also. I'll dissect a lot of vocabulary with the new podcast. But it is the undergirding of the system which is put forward that holds us down. Once you can see this, and too many people don't see it, then there's an interwovingness that starts presenting itself, and it becomes difficult to kind of perceive why a revolutionary needs to also be spiritually accurate. But then when you sit back and you allow the ancestors to show you what you're missing, you see where the true power in black liberation really lies. There is a reason there are multiple brain trusts in the Western world. And there's a reason why there's only one or two in the non-Western world. I'm not talking China now, by the way, nor Russia. I'm talking about in our world, the black world. Because intelligence for us only includes one head. But for them, it is multi-headed. It is why they call the five eyes that, which it is, the five eyes. If you don't know what the five eyes are, type it in, five eyes intelligence. There might be six now. Donald John Trump is the result of all this. And I couldn't tell you this a year ago because I didn't understand it. I didn't get it. I get it now. The requirement, therefore, of the production of this podcast here wasn't evident a year ago. Nor do I believe was it met a year ago. It simply wasn't there. We were still delusional. It might not be that bad. Donald Trump might not be that bad. It's just going to go back to usual, we would have said. But that wasn't true. That was not true. I know I hoped it was. So I had to wait. I had to wait till we were ready, until it was ready. You know how much black people like to wait. Nonetheless, here it is. Family. If you haven't done so already, I encourage you to do a couple things. Look up on Google black identity extremists and understand what that is. Because if you are not a fierce integrationist, that is what you have been labeled as. If you do not know about the books that I mentioned, Yorugu, buy it. If you don't know about Francis Cress Welsing's The ISIS Papers, buy it. If you don't know about Wade Noble's Seeking the Sakhu, S-A-K-H-U, buy it. If you don't know about Amos Wilson's Black on Black Violence, buy it. Or Blueprint for Black Power, that's a tome. Be ready for that. Buy it. If you don't know about the books, the COINTELPRO Papers by Ward, W-A-R-D, Churchill, and Jim Vanderwall, they also wrote a book called The Agents of Repression by those. If you don't know about Claude Anderson and his books, buy them. If you don't know about Neely Fuller, buy his book. I think he only has the one. I haven't seen any others by him. Why do you need to buy these things? We've been avoiding reality for quite some time. We got to stop that. We have to stop that. If you don't know about Boyce Watkins, B-O-Y-C-E, Watkins, W-A-T-K-I-N-S, friend him. You don't know about Umar Johnson, that's U-M-A-R, Johnson. Oh, I can go on and on. Reaching out to some of these people, actually. Friend them. I mean, subscribe to their stuff. Follow them. If you don't know about Bobby Hemmett, H-E-M-M-I-T-T, Phil Valentine, if you don't know about Hidden Colors, 1, 2, 3, and 4, check it. Find it. Watch it. You don't know about Black Wall Street. Check it. How about The Invention of Capitalism? That's a good book by Michael Perlman. The Invention of White, the White Race. That's another good book. That's two volumes. Working Toward Whiteness. When affirmative action was white, we have been living under a rock. It's time to come out. It's time to come out. Ah, and if you don't understand the majesticness behind your melanin, there's many ways you can find that out. Jewel Puckrum is one of them. Jewel as in J-E-W-E-L. Puckrum is, I believe, P-O-O-K-R-U-M. YouTube her. Amazing lecturess. Very smart. A doctor. But if you want to find out some real stuff about your melanin, first and foremost, do check her stuff out. John Hendrick Clark, great historian. Dr. Ben, great historian. Asada Shakur, if you can get any of her audio stuff, amazing. The woman, you'd understand why they had to exile her. You'll understand that. But on your melanin, because it's important that you understand, color is just not a color, ladies and gentlemen. Family. It's not just a color. There's a book that Bobby Hemmett actually told me about watching one of his lectures. It's called Melatonin. Breakthrough Discoveries That Can Help You by Russell J. Reiter, I think. R-E-I-T-E-R. Ph.D. And Joe Robinson, get that book. It's a book on melanin. It's a book on melanin. I won't bore you by continuing on. There's one more book that every black parent needs to have. I'm a little disappointed at myself for forgetting it, for I tell everybody to get this book. It is by a woman named Janice E. Hale. Janice, J-A-N-I-C-E, E, Hale, H-A-L-E, Black Children, Their Roots, Culture, and Learning Styles. Check that book out. We're going to cover a lot of stuff with the new podcast. It is my hope that you will listen to these podcast episodes, and an episode can be multi-parted, and you will be able to use it in your day-to-day life. The podcast you are about to hear, again, is not structured in that way, but please enjoy it anyway. This is Vyamir Adis. Peace.
A storm is rising.
America was. until this past generation a white country designed for ourselves and our posterity.
The 20th century was a bloodbath.
Constitution of the United States. So
congratulations, Mr. President. We're no longer in a period of time where we can pretend that white America somehow recognizes our humanity.
Black power ain't something that belongs to any one person. It belongs to all of us. The light of black power is not something that should just shine through a couple of individuals that where we look at them as centers of attention. It should shine through all of us. You are at the center of attention just like I am.
We're in training. The new rulers for the new age. And you can't be a tentative ruler. You can't send your power out and then look over your shoulders and wonder if it's going to happen. You have to be secure in that power. Well, we can.
You took out a full-page ad in major U.S. newspapers last year criticizing U.S. foreign policy. What would you do differently, Donald?
I'd make our allies pay their fair share. We let Japan come in and dump everything right into our markets and everything. It's not free trade. Kuwait, we make it possible for them to sell their oil. Why aren't they paying us 25% of what they're making?
This sounds like political presidential talk to me, and I know people have talked to you about whether or not you want to run. Would you ever?
Probably not.
The Reform Party is at a huge disadvantage, no matter who runs. You have the Democrats and the Republicans. For many, many years they've been there. They've got their systems. They've got hundreds of other things that the Reform Party doesn't have, which is a new party. Whoever the candidate is for the Reform Party, and I believe I could be if I decide to go that route, if I decide that I can win, I very well might announce that I will be running. But there's no question about the fact that when you run on the Reform Party, you obviously don't have the machinery in place over a tremendous number of years that the other two parties do.
Ladies and gentlemen, I am officially running for President of the United States, and we are going to make our country great again.
Is there anyone on stage who is unwilling tonight to pledge your support to the eventual nominee of the Republican Party and pledge to not run an independent campaign against that person? Again, we're looking for you to raise your hand now. Raise your hand now if you won't make that pledge tonight. Mr. Trump.
The chair is prepared to announce the results. The following candidates receive the following votes. 1,725 Trump. Accordingly, the chair announces that Donald J. Trump, having received a majority of these votes, entitled to be cast at the convention, has been selected as the Republican Party nominee for President of the United States.
We are going to make this decision now. The Fox News decision desk has called Pennsylvania for Donald Trump. This means that Donald Trump will be the 45th President of the United States.
Уважаемые дамы и господа,
Ladies and gentlemen,
несколько часов назад в Соединенных Штатах Америки завершились президентские выборы.
A few hours ago, presidential elections have finished in the United States of America.
Мы внимательно следили за этой кампанией.
We have been following this campaign with attention.
Хочу поздравить американский народ с завершением избирательного цикла.
And I'd like to congratulate the American people with the end of the electoral cycle.
А господина Дональда Трампа с победой на этих выборах.
And I'd also like to congratulate Mr. Donald Trump with his victory in these elections.
Мы слышали предвыборные заявления еще кандидата в президенты Соединенных Штатов.
We have heard his electoral slogans when he was still a candidate of the president.
Которые были направлены на восстановление отношений между Россией и Соединенными Штатами.
And he spoke about resuming and restoring relations between Russia and the United States.
Мы понимаем и отдаем себе отчет в том, что это будет непростой путь с учетом той деградации, в которой, к сожалению, находятся отношения между США и Россией.
We understand that the way to that would be difficult, taking into account the current state of degradation of relations between the U.S. and Russia.
И это, как я уже многократно говорил, не наша вина, что российско-американские отношения находятся именно в таком состоянии.
And as I have repeatedly said, that is not our fault that the Russian-American relations are in that poor state.
Но Россия готова и хочет восстановления полноформатных отношений с Соединенными Штатами.
But Russia is ready and wants to restore the full-fledged relations with the United States.
Повторяю, исходим из того, что это будет непростой путь, но мы готовы пройти и свою часть.
I repeat, we understand that this will be a difficult way, but we are ready to play our part in it.
И сделать все, чтобы вернуть российско-американские отношения на устойчивую траекторию развития.
And do everything to return the Russian-American relations to the stable and sustainable development track.
Это пошло бы на пользу как российскому, так и американскому народам.
This would serve the well-being of both Russian and American peoples.
И позитивно сказалось бы на общем климате в мировых делах, учитывая особую ответственность России и США за поддержание глобальной стабильности и безопасности.
And would have a positive effect on the general climate in the global affairs, taking into account the special responsibility of Russia and the US to sustain global stability and security.
Wade in the water.
I do believe, separate and apart from any particular election or movement, that we are going to have to guard against a rise in a crude sort of nationalism or ethnic identity or tribalism that is built around an us and a them. And I will never apologize for saying that the future of humanity and the future of the world is going to be defined by what we have in common, as opposed to those things that separate us and ultimately lead us into conflict. Take Europe. We know what happens when Europeans start dividing themselves up and emphasizing their differences. And seeing a competition between various countries in a zero-sum way. You know, the 20th century was a bloodbath. And for all the frustrations and failures of the project to unify Europe, the last five decades have been periods of unprecedented peace, growth, and prosperity in Europe. In the United States, we know what happens when we start dividing ourselves along lines of race or religion or ethnicity. It's dangerous, not just for the minority groups that are subjected to that kind of discrimination, or in some cases in the past violence, but because we then don't realize our potential as a country when we're preventing blacks or Latinos or Asians or gays or women from fully participating in the project of building American life. So my vision's right on that issue. And it may not always win the day in the short term in any particular political circumstance, but I'm confident it'll win the day over the long term, because societies in which we are able to unify ourselves around values and ideals and character and how we treat each other and cooperation and innovation ultimately are going to be more successful than societies that don't. That's my strong belief, and I think I've got pretty good evidence to prove it.
You have a chapter entitled Professor Obama. Why'd you choose those words?
The president is a very smart guy. I think he knows a lot about a lot of things. I think he would do a better job of dealing with others if he would spend less time trying to acquaint whoever he's talking to at the moment with his brilliance and more time listening. Just to draw a contrast between the president and the vice president, I've been in a number of major deals with the vice president that were important and worth doing for the country. He doesn't spend any time trying to convince me of things he knows I don't believe, and I don't spend any time trying to convince him of things that he doesn't believe. In other words, we don't waste any time on all of that. We get down to trying to figure out what we can do together, because he knows how far I can go and I know how far he can go. I think the president would be better off. He's a brilliant guy. He's successful in his political career, rising quickly to the top in American politics. But I don't think these sort of incessant lectures are very helpful in getting an outcome if you're in some kind of negotiation.
Our top political priority over the next 2 years should be to deny President Obama a second term.
As the mind-blotting shock lifts from optimistic human beings throughout this land, slowly yet humbly, the realities presented by Trump presidency are being confronted. For many, shock over the initial announcement was compounded only by overt, often psychological, but in rare cases physical, punitive injury. Injury exacted with gleeful ease against unsuspecting victims by Trump supporters who bore witness to his victory by chastising those they see as non-citizen inheritors of rights and wealth once reserved for white men and women. This trauma was then exacerbated by news outlets who sought to minimize these overt acts of racist retaliation by upplaying the protests, redefined as riots, which occurred in the election's immediate aftermath. For Black America and the many enclaves where non-white Americans of all shades and cultural histories congregate, Mr. Trump's election has ripped open their emotional souls, revealing an intolerable and depressive inner disease of self-debasement, a disease fed by the false dream many clung to of an ever-changing, more accepting America, a dream fiercely challenged by the brutal response Mr. Obama's election elicited from white conservatives and Democratic moderates alike, a dream quickly promoted by those least willing to enforce it, namely liberals and progressives, both benefactors who capitalize routinely on Black political mobility. With Mr. Trump's election to succeed Mr. Obama, Black Americans sense they had been betrayed again by both moderate and reactionary Democrats. These groups, which proved to be Black America's great stumbling block in the 1960s, were conservative in every way but name. During those tumultuous years, their conservative foundation led them to actively work against Black empowerment, both politically, by supporting Richard Nixon's blood-soaked law and order strategy, curbing black demands for just treatment in all matters involving white society and economically, by supporting black removal urban renewal projects which sought to strip wealth from black hands by raising long-standing black communities, clearing pathways for white suburban sprawl and exclusively white cultural centers. Recalling these genetic memories, we knew this group had always demonstrated an ambivalent attitude towards our community, always seeking to deprive empowerment when situations demanded enchantment and widening enfranchisement. Their role, however, in the present election was less obvious. Though election statistics suggest many abstained from voting altogether, many threw their support to Trump for what their post-election actions revealed were motivations prompted by strong racial loyalties. Loyalties exercised to recapture their perceived stolen inheritances, namely this country and its vast material empire. Evidence abounds to support this conclusion. When high school-age children refer to their classmates as niggers, or college campuses report surges in racial incidents, or elementary-aged black children report in tearful confessions how long-standing school chums behaved like veteran Klansmen to them and others like them in Trump's victorious wake, one cannot deny what most supporters intended to communicate with their casted vote. Not since that bygone era, before pop music made black entertainment indispensable to the white masses, could black men and women of all ages recall with ice-chilling honesty such massively demonstrated deviancy. As in the days following George Zimmerman's acquittal, many black Americans and non-white Americans who could not only readily identify with Trayvon Martin, but more precisely could see themselves in place of the young man, feel this betrayal deep within themselves. Many see Mr. Trump's ascension as a stark repudiation of their desire to be at once both within this country's borders as citizens constitutionally protected and within this world without being considered persecuted minorities. Consequently, they see his election as a rejection of their efforts to be seen as more than orphaned colonial subjects, forced adrift as domestic refugee immigrants, both unwanted and undesired within this given homeland. In Mr. Trump and his enthusiastic supporters, they see a popular uprising steeped in the demagogic American tradition of white vigilantism, an uprising rife with the unmistakable stench of Eurocentric conquering, an uprising etched from the sun-warped foundation from whence this country's society's basis for existence is created. They see Trump's election as the last attempt by an increasingly minority population to make for themselves a new country, one where the best jobs, best homes, and best leisurely activities are reserved for their European heirs, a country where social norms gloss over racial customs in order to create a negatively peaceful coexisting environment, an environment absent real conflict but heavy with tension. Presently, very few Euro-Americans desire to hear these concerns. Even fewer wish to understand their origins. Most all seem prepared to commit themselves to an unexpressed vision wherein business and politics become so significantly intermingled, any attempt at separating them will be futile. The emergence of the desire for this intercourse between economic business interests, politicians, and traditional white nationalist fundamentalism is not new, nor should it be seen as surprising. For decades, conservative capitalist financiers and their industrialist cronies have subliminally connected business ethics with political ends. They have mixed public interests with public motives, insisting both sought the same aims and desired the same goals, those being to form a more prosperous nation with a bulging managerial middle class and ever-shrinking service-oriented lower class. Conservative commentators specifically have peddled the false idea that the country was a business and thus had to be run like one, insinuating in their advocacy that businessmen could manage the government's bureaucratic structure with more ease than politicians, securing greater results, due in part to their experience running large corporations with comparable structures. From a historical view, we see a similar unification of business and politics in the early American Industrial Revolution and America's early colonial days, when the colonies were little more than chartered corporations for the burgeoning British Empire. More, many historians, when talking about the Ku Klux Klan's rise to prominence in the United States, fail to see the fascistic nature inscribed in the organization's functions. Many downplay the blatant corporate and business connections within the organizational structure, and how its secret societal codes promoted a corporate government enterprise which excluded non-white men and women from positions influential to the power levers, invisible to the masses, and hidden by its Aryan rhetoric. Donald Trump inherits this legacy, a legacy many voters invoked when they voiced their support to, quote, make America great again, unquote. In the days following his election, the true meaning hidden behind these words were displayed with great indignity throughout this land. They were heard dripping from the brash lips of youth overjoyed at the prospect Trump presented for their future, and seen scribbled onto surfaces ranging from notebook paper to the back wall of baseball field dugouts. They were words which triggered dormant celestial and genetic memories, words promising annihilation to those not seen as part of America's national family. Trump, these words insisted, would, quote, make America white again, unquote. They communicated with unobstructed clarity a projected vision wherein non-white nationals were evicted from all cultural consideration and relegated to political disenfranchisement, economic disempowerment, and ultimately pushed completely into a pre-subordinated lower caste stratum. We as Black Americans must analyze these words for their true consequence, realizing that this nation, which has so often seen us as immigrants within its own borders, has come now to a point in history where, to quote Mark Blythe, the era of neoliberalism is over, the era of neo-nationalism has just begun, unquote. This truth is evident all over the so-called Western world, as faux left parties who have spent the previous half century offering lukewarm incremental fixes to capitalism's obvious contradictions find themselves lacking legitimacy among the masses of everyday people, whom under daily affliction by capitalism's torturous profit-driven aims are tired of the brute physical exploitation and psychological purging necessary to sustain modernization's onward march. The alt-right in many ways speaks to this frustration, However, instead of unifying the triple-prong evils ravaging their daily lives, creating from that unification class-conscious analyses, they have instead looked to the European age-old crutch, racial caste, to explain their problems, preventing themselves from seeing the path leading to their modern predicament. For this reason, the alt-right is merely an ancestral arm of the right-wing white supremacist organizations from 50 years ago. It is the rebranding of the conservative fundamentalism which sprang from the 1960s civil rights gains, a metamorphosis built from the neoconservative law and order movement spearheaded by Goldwater, Reagan, and Nixon. This movement, which positioned itself as a more palatable white nationalism devoid of crude names, harsh, overt segregation policies, and unabashed stereotypical entertainment, sought to shrink government to a size where it could be metaphorically drowned in a bathtub. First, for the benefit of, quote, real Americans, unquote, but second, for the not too widely touted benefit of corporations. Mainstream white conservatives saw both ends as beneficial to them, as history had showed a clear track record wherefrom white Americans could glean their overvalued position to corporations within this country. This convinced many anti-civil rights, anti-affirmative action, Main Street conservatives to advocate corporate-friendly policies, believing, as they did, that their families would benefit from their corporate liberation efforts, just as their ancestors had benefited from the corporate tyranny which colored the Industrial Revolution. Here we find the origin waters from whence modern neoliberal and libertarianism spring from. Donald Trump is merely the blossoming flower projected from this well-rooted history and its ever-reaching cultural stem. Black America must heed the sour stench riding the political winds from this flowering. All over Europe, the neo-nationalist fervor is rising. America is just a willing outpost for its crippling rage. We must question with brutal honesty who among our friends have within them our best interests. We must see with uncolored eyes the inconsistencies within Western civilization which led to this white moon rising. We must see that within the lives of most Western citizens, black gains have been met with fear, derision, and rebuke. They see us as parasites, as unashamed intruders who contribute nothing but entertainment to their higher culture. When we do succeed, they see such success as originating from a racial card game where we need only toss a racist accusation onto the corporate card table to render all other applicants disqualified. This, of course, is not true. Yet it is an idea which has been popularized since the race card was first inserted as the sole reason why O.J. Simpson was acquitted of murder. Since its insertion into the popular Western mind, race card gaming has been used to dismiss racism while promoting reverse racism as a symptom of black hatred for white America. From a subconscious point of view, Trump's ascendancy is a counteracting force against the race card concept. For in another usage, Trump is itself a card, one played to overtake all others set down before it. Thus, we could conclude by his placement in the White House that he represents not only a reassertion of white Western dominance domestically, but also a tacit nod to white nationalist fervor throughout the Northern Hemisphere. Proof lending credibility to this conclusion is found in his given name, Donald. a name with Gaelic roots, which translates to, quote, ruler of the world, unquote. More, the incoming First Lady, whose name and accent are foreign in sound, bears a name whose root is melos, a Greek word defined as black or dark. Considering Trump is defined by one dictionary as meaning to obtrude or to eject, push forward, or out by fraud, subconsciously, Western civilization could see the Trumps as a last-ditch effort to obstruct an increasingly disturbing negative birth trend by asserting their willingness to push out and eject all non-white civilians unwilling to compromise their heretical positions. To many listeners, this may sound fanciful or even illogical. They may insist briskly to make such a claim without concrete proof to substantiate it is irresponsible. To them, my only answer is, we are confronted with coincidences which seem to outdistance the broad definitional framework of the word. Logically, therefore, my responsibility is to present the information as it exists to enable the rational mind to force itself beyond the boundaries coincidence constructs. This, I suspect, will only be the beginning of an era when such boundaries will be pushed. As noted by former Labor Secretary Robert Reich in a Truthdig article, there are 15 actions tyrants use or demonstrate to take control of democracies. Among that long list are exaggerate their mandate to govern, claim massive voter fraud in the absence of any evidence, turn the public against journalists, and tell the public big lies. Taken together, these actions form a delusionary state within the public psyche, causing truth and fiction to blur, inciting morality and immorality to become disjointed and ultimately over-reliant on personal truth, personal conviction, and mandates presented by the ultimate destiny determiner, the one who garners personal allegiance, dictating the public course by writ and fiat. This destiny determiner has come onto this country's shores before, leaving fear where once optimism reigned. His name is almost always hidden by the masses, for he appears in multiple places in multiple forms, yet his calling signature is always the same. Tis Uncle, tis Sam, tis the Great One who marvels at peace, believing as he watches brightly burning hope, tis what's never more ripe for war's glory in battle call. Let us take stock now before the flames beset Sam's motioning tongue calls our grain from harvest to the doughboys entrenched in far-off fields. This may seem fanciful, but given the trajectory we find our present day on, it is nonetheless apt. We needn't be swayed, therefore, by empty internal assurances that busyness will enable a resetting of the trend, nor can we be pressed by outer disbelief to ignore the historical trends seeking to drive us into an unforgiving, unrelenting darkness. We must face this threat and see clearly the hovering shadows drawing us closer to the dark abyss, which will ultimately reveal to us the final act for Western civilization and possibly mankind. Already, we are seeing the delusionary state materialize, as the idea surrounding victory and all its meaning has been turned on its head. Twice in the first two decades of this century, a person who has received the least amount of national votes has ascended to the White House. In both instances, polling prior to the election cycle suggested the country was headed for a left-wing turn politically. Yet in both instances, hard right candidates were handed the keys to power. A quick glance at America's political map suggests such victories are conclusions easily wrought from raw data. Yet the map doesn't account for the popular vote totals, only which party received the most votes. Neither do they reveal population density nor demographics, both important indicators of political weight. In both the 2000 and 2016 elections, the more populous regions skewed against conservative candidates overwhelmingly. Yet the Electoral College suppressed their rebuke, paving over a social commonwealth mandate with a corporate welfare platform. Here I am not trying to suggest the Democratic Party's nominee for both years were friendlier to the ideas championed by all liberationists. I am simply painting a contextual mood from whence to draw the previous statement from. In this most recent election, Hillary Clinton was easily cast as a Wall Street crony whose Washington career had benefited Main Street far less than the steel high-rise Wall Street masters calling her political tune. Undergirding this characterization was a well-sourced accusation of racial scapegoating, a charge relying heavily on Mrs. Clinton's robust support for her husband's 1994 crime bill in statements surrounding her advocacy for that bill. Though she and her husband offered half-hearted apologies and milquetoast explanations in an attempt to tamp down criticism over the bill, a new black generation refused to accept their pandering, relying instead on the recent justice miscarriages orchestrated by the Clinton Foundation to demonstrate their obvious disdain for black Americans and melanated people throughout the globe. Many recalled Mrs. Clinton's backhanded treatment of Barack Obama during the waning primary contest in 2008. They recalled how her campaign had tried soiling the then senator's public image by leaking a photo of him in traditional African garb. They recalled how she had winked unflinchingly at the prospect of the senator's assassination. But when even these memories weren't present, this new generation could recall with bitter clarity the toll visited upon the black community after the crime bill became law. As if a mass fever struck entire neighborhoods, in a few years' time, whole blocks of family units saw sibling after sibling, cousin after cousin, and neighbor after neighbor disappear into the vast mass incarceration system, often for petty crimes, which became magnified under the new bill. Members of this new generation could without great difficulty rehash story after story detailing the death spiral afflicting their friends, family, and neighbors. Many could attest to the eagerness many new officers showed in apprehending black bodies for their quota systems, and still many more could find only solemn stares when recalling comrades who, try as they might, couldn't handle the pressure placed on them by a society which devalued black life, a pressure they released in vicious, self-hating, self-destroying rampages, usually resulting in the deletion of a fellow black comrade and their incarceration for life. These memories were all too familiar within this new generation's mind when the Clintons asked them to forget the past and believe their promises to reconcile the mistakes they created there. To that generation, the pain wrought from those mistakes muted any attempts by the Clintons to overwrite their previous legacy with a new one. For this reason, black youth were less than eager to pull the lever for a second Clinton presidency. Yet nearly all still did. In fact, nearly 90% of black Americans voted for Mrs. Clinton, while less than half of all white Americans and nearly 65% of both Hispanic and Asian Americans voted for her as well. This stark truth underscores a contradictory reality. Though destructive to their community, black America is still the most loyal Democratic Party demographic, yet they receive little compensation for their loyalty and often are left defenseless against conservative attacks on their constitutional rights. These attacks are predicated on conservative acknowledgement of the fact that black Americans represent the most existential threat to Republican politics. While most mainstream commentators refuse to acknowledge this fact, focusing instead on subgroup analysis, most specifically black women and homosexuals, conservatives have wasted little effort in curtailing black America's impact on their electoral agenda. These efforts can be seen and the immediate events surrounding this year's election. While much attention has been given to the role no-collar, lower-class white voters, the so-called forgotten majority, played in providing Trump with the boost required to recapture Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Michigan, little attention has been paid to irregularities within many black precincts. Prior to and in the immediate aftermath of the 2016 elections, investigative journalists Greg Palast and Brad Friedman documented voter suppression tactics deployed by Republicans to curb Democratic election numbers. They noted how voter machine distribution, voter roll purges, and Sunday voting constriction, a day typically reserved for church voting activities, were utilized in many non-white precincts to dramatically decrease voter enfranchisement access. Tactics ignored by mainstream Democratic politicians, yet tactics known by fair voting proponents as occurring throughout this country with impunity. As documented by Mr. Friedman and Mr. Palast, such voting suppression tactics have been deployed unabated for nearly two decades. Their cost, widely viewed in the documentary Blackout, include 2000 selection of George W. Bush, his re-selection in 2004, and with this election's outcome, one will struggle not to see Mr. Trump's ascension to the White House as further consequential evidence pointing to these tactics' destructiveness. Yet these tactics remain in place, ready for deployment during the next election cycle. However, having gone unchecked for so long, their impact is now affecting white Democratic voters, who are targeted by the conservative and traditionalist Republican apparatus as threats to their corporate Confederate loyalties. Loyalties hidden by slick, metaphor-filled sales pitches which speak to the inner demons of their supporters, calling the worst nostalgia-driven tendencies from them, while burying their mentalities in the past where nothing was outside the reach of divinely mandated white power. Unfortunately for those lower-class loyalists who have chosen to cling to this past, history lays bare the self-harm within its unfolding and stands now as a warning against repeating the same mistakes made by their forebears. history sternly prophesizes, as white authorship is exercised without restraint, depressed economic and social conditions for the lower class loyalists who falsely see themselves as heirs to this country's vast wealth is the result imposed on them by those at society's highest level. By way of strictly manipulating the resources available to the loyalists, those at society's top impose harsh, regimented schemes onto the items required for sustenance, draining their local economies dry while simultaneously ripping apart their social fabric. The end result is an environment where corporate dominance over the federal government and corporate ownership and control over loyalist municipalities and utilities shrink human beings to nothing more than resources, transforming loyalists into the peon roles prescribed non-white beings who stood as the initial victims of naked white aggression and corporate pillaging at this country's birthing. This prophecy is being realized today. The consorted effort to privatize government functions and the multi-generational contracts allotted to profit-driven companies are merely extensions of the late 19th century desire to make government wholly accountable to corporate power by yanking it firmly into private ownership from its more traditional common trust position. These truths shine a bright light onto the dilapidated state this country's democratic processes are in. No more are voter suppression tactics hidden or denied, nor is the vision presented to loyalists hidden by metaphor. Tactics are executed legally with little opposition from the citizenry, who condones the actions executed because they believe they will benefit directly from them, missing as they do the true extent of the power they are sanctioning. Some well-versed historian in a decade far off in the future may marvel at white society's collective acceptance of this blatantly tainted system. They may wrestle to explain how modern white Americans see themselves as the citizen heirs of the land, how had allowed themselves to become foolish spectators in a field more vital to their livelihood than any other, that being the political field. They may, upon examining completely the evidence available, have no choice but to conclude that their American ancestors, living in this the second decade of this new millennium, had become so intoxicated by their rich, decadent culture that they hid in their fear when called to confront the overburdening shadows stretched over it. This historical conclusion will most certainly be followed by an inquiry into why their ancestors seemed content with allowing the needs of their society to go unmet. With brutal honesty, they may be led to describe with tears in their eyes a civilization so involved in seeking solace in bygone achievements rather than combing the farthest frontiers of their inner imaginations to bring justice in all forms to this weary planet. Their complacency, those historians might have to admit, never allowed their white ancestors to become comfortable with those required historical elements which give rise to true social progress: commonwealth, social welfare, non-aggressive diplomacy, and cultural acceptance and dignity. The blindness so obstructed their eyes from the self-made cataclysm amassing on the horizon, they were prevented from both articulating and projecting a new self-sustaining, self-repenting, and ultimately soul-saving vision which would have surely led to cultural revitalization. Oh, how things do look different from a future's vantage point. what clarity such a point can bring to modern circumstances. Yet its greatest gift is its formlessness. Yes, we can see where we might end up if we don't change, but with grace and honesty, we can use that vision to change our present, altering the future in the process. Time, as always, mirrors back the actions undertaken by committed souls. Souls fueled justly by divine inspiration and moral decency. Unfortunately, time also mirrors back those actions undertrodden by carelessly foolish spirits. Spirits mercilessly inebriated by childish immortality. Black Americans, as always, will play a dual role in setting ablaze time's visionary hourglass. First, Black Americans will play the role of the devoted monk who holds fast to their religious tenets during ages where such reverence invites execution. Second, they will play the role of self-concerned outcasts, a role carrying an ever-looming curse, threatening to devour us even as it propels forward our ambitions. We must acknowledge at the outset the magnitude and evolution associated with its modern fulfillment. Acknowledgement built from a modern-day legacy drawn from experiences entrusting us with bitter truths and sugar-sweet possibilities. Acknowledging this legacy and its predetermined variables shifts our bitterness to sweetness, raising our eyes to the second more personally and communally beneficial role, a role shedding the traditionally preferable unconscious counselor role, wherein we inscribe our blessings onto our oppressors by offering advice on morally dominating preceding generations, hoping as we do, their hearts will open their eyes, allowing them to see their felonious ways. Ridding our souls of this burdensome role opens our beings to play the grandmaster role encoded in our genetics. It is an intellectually invigorating conscious role wherein we uptake a consciously self-centered communal road benefiting our people economically, politically, and social-culturally without seeking to trod under those who sought to rule us. It is a role wherein our eternal torch, hope, is fed by a steady fuel of artistry, esteem, respect, and courage. It is the role we begin to embody nearly six decades ago, a role so fear-inducing within the white authoritarian governor's mind, it was restricted by white traditionalists and their conservative cohorts, before being replaced altogether by today's black urban misfit, the ghettoized mainstream African-American thug who loathes education, enjoys incarceration, and proudly displays his familial deviancy as a badge of true colonial Africanness. Imbued within the second role, this black African indigenous being role, lies the ability to re-envision the world, to create a new dream impression for this deflated and slowly suffocating reality. In the process of demonstrating our personal attentiveness, we will also inject Western civilization with the conscious aptitude necessary to reconstruct a greater, more egalitarian America, an America more adherent to the dignity and cultural worthiness of the true first world people, and more readily, at least for a moment in time, to deal constructively with their self-created problems. Fulfilling this later task will be, in one word, difficult, especially as this country continues fragmenting among regional and ethnic lines. We must learn diligently to be at once dedicated to uplifting our black brethren and sistren while caring deeply for those many non-black residents who truly want a better way to life. Black radicalism often rejects this call as futile. Yet consciousness, the trumpeting sounds reigning within us when our souls make contact with its divine destiny, requires we take on this hefty role for the betterment of our souls. Consciousness, that destiny harmonizing descending spirit, recalibrates our inner beings to true north. It realigns our souls with our ancestral credo, raising our concerns from ancient rivalries to ancient civilities, recalling our capacity to bring about the moving wisdom of God onto this planet to work, to impart miracles, and to dispatch justice. The old Hopi texts tell us presently we are living in the final hours before either a sweltering terrestrial fever evaporates this great work, or a grand upsurge of terrestrial power elevates this great cosmic work to new divinial heights. In accordance with ancient prophecies all over the world, one people must decide its fate. As their collective repositories, our ancientness calls us to re-envision the world and nudge it, wherever possible, towards the light of dignity, truth, and justice. Today, such nudging must come in the form of direct embodiment. We mustn't sacrifice grace and dignity anymore to the titillating yet elusive integration dream promoted by Dr. King's revisionists. We must stand proudly and accept not only our place under the sun, but our place in ancestral prophecy. We must stand honorably accepting allegiance not to false virtues, but to healthy righteousness, paying deference to our inner ancestral vision and our inner ancestral comrades. This is what Donald Trump's election ultimately means for us. New leadership, new vision, new determination, new destiny. For 50 years, we have been cast into an uncharted wilderness, one where our leadership either became prey for hungry jackals or where they stumbled deliriously into the false promises offered by their desert-dwelling sirens. During these communal shattering years, Black Americans have still held tightly onto the promise of equal treatment. And though no action undertaken by their white counterparts suggests the promise will ever be honored, we still search out its fulfillment in our everyday life. Moving forward, we must now summon the courage to finally accept the reality confronting us, that equal treatment, as promised by every white generation since this country's founding, is merely a dream. It is the ever-present hope extended to an abuse victim by their abuser. It is the momentary human vulnerability revealed every time the abused begins sobering up from the pain inflicted by the abuser. It is the lie perpetuated constantly by the abuser to maintain their hold onto the abused spiritual vitality. It is naught but a lie, a coy ploy masqueraded as truth. The alt-right reminds us of its falseness, as do the neoliberals and capitalists within the white left. They tell us in one rousing, joyous voice that we are the subjects bequeathed them by the old world order. Thus, within the coming economic infrastructure being readied by China and their Western financiers, we will again be the serf-bound caste subjects, unbefitting consideration for any position of true power. Our minds must be molded by them. Our hearts set running to their regimented tune. And if ambitions arise naturally, they must seek subordination gleefully, bemoaning freedom as counterproductive and liberation as counter-thoughtful. In this climate, adherence to deeply rooted principles, fundamentally liberationist and optimistically clear-eyed, shedding the innocent belief in equal treatment, our vision must surpass delusional dreaming. It must encapsulate a compassionate, soul-centered communal reality, benefiting our people economically, politically, and social-culturally without barring equitable trade and dealings with all non-black inhabitants who willfully demonstrate an eagerness to adhere to this higher consciousness vision. Ours must be a vision not derived from equal treatment under the law, but drawn from equal treatment above the law. Our religion, therefore, must be true freedom, in actions descended upon us from our Creator. We must construct our vision using a revolutionary intuition reconstituted from the historical records left to us by ancestors laying dormant within our common memories. True freedom must necessarily carry as its most sacred tenet black liberationist theosophy, encoding within us a monk-like zealousness, utilizing yogi practices to meld body, mind, soul to the task prescribed. For America, this role will invite jealousy and scorn from its reactionary forces. Yet more graciously, such actions will elicit greater piety, dignity, and resilient action from culturally unmoored black beings, infecting potential white allies with the liberationist hue celebrated by their history books. Together, we shall take forward this country toward a truly common purpose and common interest humanitarian sunscape, to play at once the chief role in determining America's destiny, to lift onto our shoulders the ever-burdening curse of uptaking both the consciously self-centered communal road benefiting only our people, and the ancient co-creator, co-abortive, radical revolutionary seeker aiming to inject America and Western civilization with the conscious aptitude necessary to deal constructively with their own self-creative problems. To take on this curse is not something we willfully accept. Yet a close look at history suggests its presence at our every turn. Though at this crucial point, when white nationalism ejects any political solution that doesn't subjugate itself to white cultural mandates or abate its steadily sinking birth rates, we must be willing to dissolve this curse with an uncompromising, unmitigated truth. That truth being the white backlash which characterized the end of the civil rights era has led to an era heavy with signs pointing to a white catharsis or a cleansing from the white social psychological spirit or white social culture altogether of what it perceives to be impure conditions promoted by non-white people which has led their societies to ruin. Anyone familiar with alt-right white nationalist music and propaganda knows its proponents are overly concerned with protecting white physical beauty from intermingling with non-white beastliness. They describe any and all things non-white as sordid and base, as unintellectual and unintuitive, as childish and naive. To them, all non-white human beings are subhuman criminals and resources who ought praise white God for afflicting their subspecies with the white man's genius generosity, and grotesqueness. They are now setting the stage for a movement towards disintegration and mass conflict. Donald Trump is neither the puppeteer promoting this movement nor the innocent businessman who has stumbled into its richly enshrined caverns. He is merely an opportunist who sees the writing on the proverbial wall and seeks to take advantage of the environment while advantage can be taken. This is the ultimate danger in his ascension to the presidency. Over the coming 4 years, we must ready ourselves for this conflict. We must reconstitute our tightly bound communities and resurrect those tools to bind us together against the onslaught history warns us will be tossed at us. This is the only way we will assure our soul's survival through this time period in the coming darkness so evident on the horizon. Thank you.
Whoa, oh, mercy, mercy me. All things ain't what they used to be now. Where did all the blue skies go? Poison is the wind that blows from the north and south and east.
Hello, family. This is Vonnegut Deese. That is, of course, the great elder, the late elder, may he rise in power, Marvin Gaye. You hear him in the background right now. Oh, mercy, mercy me. Things ain't what they used to be. I gotta tell you before I wrap up the show, we need so much more. To all of my musicians out there, to all of my artists out there, we need you to start getting together in a constructive and earnest form to reconnect to the real roots of our community and to start producing soul music again. You can produce soul music in hip-hop simultaneously. But I need you who are listening to this, if you know musicians, encourage them to put their energies with other black people. To research, what is music structure? What goes into actually crafting music from the back forward? Meaning, the different parts of music. What do the notes do? What is music therapy? How can music therapy be used to heal the psyche, the emotionality of the person? And then how do you properly construct a music concept? And to take the idea that you have in the back of your mind and then pull it forward to create a full song. Encourage those musicians to get together, not with one or two or three people, but with four or five. If you produce beats, work with other people to produce beats so that there are multifaceted concepts going into those beats. Have one person work strictly on the percussions, another one specifically on the strings, another one specifically on this part, another one on that part, and then put that all together. We're going to be talking about more of that in the new year. That'll be coming down the way. I'm hoping to be able to work with some musicians to create really insightful and deep musical projects. If you're a musician or you know musicians, please have them get a hold of me. I'd love to make their music known as long as they're following the message that we're going to be promoting on this show. I hope to make them some money in the next couple of years. Join this team that I'm building so we can put out the best podcast anyone has seen. We need more Marvin Gaye's. We need more Teddy Pendergrass's. We need people who are going to be dedicated to putting black soul music out so that black souls can grow and they can expand and they can help heal We need that. I have a transcript of the speech. I will be posting it. I'd like to know what you think of the speech. I'd like to know what you think of the podcast. And any ideas, what do you think? When you think of a black podcast, what would you like to hear? Contact me. My email's up top there. Contact me. I'd like to know. I thank you for giving me some of your time tonight. I thank you for giving me some of your energy. It's an amazing thing that we can do together. I hope that the ancestors bless you. And that the Godic energies, we're going to be talking a lot about what God actually is and means from the standpoint of a linguistic viewpoint. The Godic, G-O-D-I-C energies, and why that's important. I hope you accelerate upward so you can bring that energy downward and then expand it out to touch the world, to defeat your enemies, to bless your compatriots and your comrades. We need to talk more about compatriots and comrades. The hell with allies. We need compatriots and we need comrades. Look up what they mean. Get yourself that dictionary, 1970 or before. Random House, Funks and Wagnalls. That literally is Funk and Wagnalls. That's a dictionary type. Wagnalls, W-A-G-N-A-L-L-S. I actually have a 2-volume set of Funk and Wagnalls. If you can get your hands on it and you want to spend the money, Oxford's complete dictionary set. Get the original one. I'm not saying don't get the newer one. But the original one is the one that it took them about 100 years to complete. You want to understand why the English language is so dang confusing? Get that huge set of dictionaries. Man, there's so much more I could have put in this podcast. But I decided to limit it. May the ancestors bless you. God again, Jesus. May all that you desire and need to survive this coming turmoil be provided. We now need to unify with one another. We need to reach out to Africa. We need to be together with each other. We must have safe havens to go to now because things are likely to get worse. I wish you all the best, and I will see you again in the new year with a new podcast if the ancestors are willing to walk me through. Peace to you all. This is Vibrant Beats, a.k.a. Kenamuke, the El Kabalani. Peace.
Tell old Pharaohs to let my people go.
Let my people go.
So Moses went to Egypt land.
Let my people go.
He made old Pharaoh understand.
Let my people go.
Yes, the Lord said, go down.
Go down.
Moses.
Moses.
Way down.
Down.
In Egypt land. Tell all Pharaohs to let my people go.
Let my people go.
Old Moses said,
let my people go.
If not, I'll smite your firstborn dead.
Let my people go.
Cause the Lord said, go down.
Go down.
Moses.
Moses.
Way down.